यार पेज नंबर 673 इन द
अच्छा
स्मॉल
लेकिन
एडिशन दैट इज डीलक्स एडिशन वी रेड दिस. दीज आर द थ्री फंडामेंटल वेज ऑफ सीइंग. एम आई करेक्ट और मे बी
ओह देयर वर
और
फोर वेज ऑफ
नो?
सीइंग राइट.
वी जस्ट रेड इट एंड आई थिंक यू कैन जस्ट रीड इट वंस और हाउ या वी कैन रीड इट वंस एंड देन वी कैन रेज्यूम. ज्योति वुड यू लाइक टू रीड?
या श्योर. कैन यू हियर मी?
यस.
ओके. दीज आर द थ्री फंडामेंटल वेज ऑफ सीइंग, ईच विद इट्स मेंटल एटीट्यूड टुवर्ड्स लाइफ दैट कैन बी अडॉप्टेड विद रिगार्ड टू आवर एग्जिस्टेंस. The rest are usually midway stations or else variations of composites which attempt to adapt themselves more freely to the complexity of the problem. For practically, it is impossible for man taken as a race, whatever a few... Oh, speak a little louder.
Yes,
is that,
this
is
much
that
better.
Okay,
yes,
is that
thanks.
Better?
Yeah.
Okay.
No.
Whatever a few individuals may
No, it's
succeed
gone down
in
again.
Doing
The
to guide
middle
his
man,
life
she said, is it much better?
or
It was much better.
wholly
Tell her again once more.
By the leading motive of any of these three attitudes, uniquely to the exclusion of the others' claim upon his nature.
In the middle when she said, it was very loud.
A confused amalgam of two or more of them, a conflict or division of his life motive between them, or some attempt at synthesis, is his way of dealing with the various impulses of his complex being and the intuitions of his mind to which they appeal for their sanction. Okay, hold on, let me put this thing up quickly. Okay, that's much better, right? And of course I've lost a sanction. Almost all men normally devote the major part of their energy to the life on earth, to the terrestrial needs, interests, desires, ideals of the individual and the race. It could not be otherwise, for the care of the body, the sufficient development and satisfaction of the vital and the mental being of man, the pursuit of high individual and large collective ideals, which start from the idea of an attainable human perfection or nearer approach to perfection through his normal development, are imposed upon us by the very character of our terrestrial being. They are part of its law, its natural impulse and rule, its condition of growth. And without these things, man could not attain to his full manhood. Any view of our being which neglects unduly, belittles or intolerantly condemns them, is therefore by that very fact, whatever its other truth or merit or utility, whatever its suitability to individuals of a certain temperament or in a certain stage of spiritual evolution, unfit to be the general and complete rule of human living. Nature takes good care that the race shall not neglect these aims, which are a necessary part of her evolution, for they fall within the method and stages of the divine plan in us, and a vigilance for her steps and for the maintenance of their mental and material ground is a preoccupation which she cannot allow to go into the background, since these things belong to the foundation and body of her structure. Or shall I stop there?
Yes. So we read this last time, and the point Sri Aurobindo is making is that each of these views is really a kind of a sort of exclusive view. And this exclusive view does not encompass the whole of life, or whole of our experience of life. And so, most human beings, in some way or the other, sort of have to take account of each of these in their own lives. And even if they believe in one, and there are, you know, interesting thing is often these extreme exclusionary sort of, you know, viewpoints are held by lay people who are, you know, in the practice very different from what they claim to believe in. Mm-hmm. For example, the Jains, who were in some sense, you know, sort of they adhered to a philosophy or an extreme kind of life negating kind of sort of viewpoint, viewpoint of reality and a goal of life which wanted to take them into the beyond, completely into the beyond, similar to Buddhism in some sense, into the absolute.
Everybody got this thing.
Or it's just us.
Tell him we got this thing. Sita.
So, to continue with that paragraph, Sri Aurobindo presents these three views in a separate way, because in terms of the mind, each one takes a kind of an exclusive position. But there is a deeper reality to these three views as well. And that is what I touched upon last time, in that they relate to the three avasthas that are spoken of in the Upanishads. And these three avasthas, Jagrat, Swapna and Sushupti, leading to the Turiya, are each of them a certain kind of a station or concentration of Brahman. So Brahman presents itself to itself. That is, it's a, like a self-presentation through forms of tapasya. I mean, of forms of the concentration of its own reality or presentation. And these are the three ways in which it presents itself. As an objective being, as a subjective being, and as a non-dual being. And so these, in some way, become the three ways in which we need to experience Brahman. Brahman experiences itself, and we, as the sort of projections of consciousness, are also kept in those forms of tapas, or forms of concentration. In our normal condition, and that's why he uses the term nature there. Whenever Sri Aurobindo uses the term nature, we have to see it in its double sense. The Western idea of nature, which is like an intelligence, a universal intelligence, arising from matter but containing a certain kind of focus of technology within it, an intelligence within it, a rationality within it, and also of nature as a kind of a term for the Indian notion of prakriti, with its both its polarities of para and apara prakriti, in other words, the lower nature and the higher nature. So here he is trying to point out that nature makes sure that in the mass, in the race, we are not allowed to affirm either the supra-terrestrial or the supra-cosmic view of existence as primary. And that in the race, we are kept bound to some extent to the cosmic or terrestrial view of existence as primary. And this is because this particular level, or, you know, this condition, avastha of jagrat, the objective or waking condition, needs its development, because here it is that there is a certain kind of key to progression. This is the field, the primary field of manifestation, evolutionary manifestation. And so there is a certain kind of interdependence between these three, and a certain kind of, you know, I mean, we can ideationally think of them as separate, and also put our, you know, own weight behind any one of these in our own lives, but at the same time there is a certain kind of, you know, a power beyond the human, a tapas of Brahman itself, that keeps us with our senses turned outwards, as it were, with our consciousness sort of focused outwards. And we can defy this, and we need to defy this because that is part of the growth into consciousness by a certain kind of an action against the grain.
Is he online? So these four avasthas will stay on till the end, and there will be different stations that any being can take during the manifestation.
Yes, because these are concentrations of Brahman or self. Presentations of Brahman, the way Brahman presents itself to itself. However, as these four avasthas literally in a certain sense are resolved or reconciled when you enter into the third, the prajna condition. That is why the non-dual condition, in the so-called supracosmic, as he is considering it, you may say he is looking more at the fourth, the Turiya state, the absolute, the state that denies subject and object rather than reconciles them in a non-duality. So essentially, yes, that there may be beings, and these are conditions of consciousness in which beings may be trapped in a sense, or may experience even freely in the freedom of spirit. Free beings may experience Brahman in any one of these avasthas, as it were, either objective or subjective, or non-dual or absolute.
So the integral avastha is not there in one of these four?
Yeah, integral avastha would be the non-dual one. That is actually the sushupti, the prajna condition, where there is a certain kind of a transcendence, but at the same time and a kind of an origin of both jagrat and swapna. Now that can, you see, so these conditions that we are talking about can become fields of manifestation. So a whole universal life belongs to the Jagrat condition. It's the world as we know it, for example. Then there is a universal life that belongs to the Swapna condition. That would be the condition of the inner planes and all the gods, goddesses, and demons and subtle beings. And then and all the sort of, you know, psychological forces and qualities. And then you might talk about a supramental world. Now, the whole idea, as he's talking about a spiritual evolution, is that these conditions, even if they have a certain, like Shyam was saying, a kind of an eternal reality, are also, you know, sort of coexist with their own modified realities, because there is the implosion of the Sushupti condition into Jagrat and Swapna through a evolution of consciousness. That is, as it were, both the dream worlds and the waking worlds can actually be transformed in that, you know, in that evolution.
So in the hierarchy of the avasthas, the most concrete is the Jagrat, and so it becomes most subtle in the Turiya. But when we see these different outlooks of life, Turiya is not the most sublime, right? It is the Sushupti state. Turiya, if it is corresponding to the absolute or the negation.
Yeah, it is not the negation, it is the absolute. So, if it is the absolute, also we cannot really use the word subtle. We can use the word subtle for swapna. We can use the word material or gross for the jagrat. But when we talk about the Sushupti, we are talking about a state that has already become non-dual. So it is not really subtle. It is material at the same time. And when we are talking about Turiya, we are talking about the absolute. In other words, it's also not subtle, but it is unthinkable, inconceivable. Indescribable,
mm-hmm.
and will always remain so, because that is the absoluteness of its infinity potential.
And these four states have been linked to the word Om.
Yes, that is in that specific Upanishad, because that becomes the bridge there. That particular Upanishad deals with Om as the uniting or integrating factor. In other words, Brahman has become, in this vibrational mode, all these four avasthas. So these are, when they say that it is the Om, basically they are saying that there is a certain kind of integral vibration that has configured itself in these four ways.
So Devashishda, these are Devashishda, where does the notion of Purusha come in these avasthas? When we say avasthas, we are dealing with Prakriti, right?
No, not necessary. Because you see, when we are dealing with avasthas, they also, you see, the Upanishad itself talks about how the Lord presents himself in each of these avasthas, right? In Jagrat, he presents himself as Vaishvanara, okay? In Swapna, he presents himself as Hiranyagarbha. In Sushupti, he presents himself as Prajna. Now, these are all the Purusha, the Purusha of these states. So, it is both Purusha and Prakriti in each case.
Okay. So, Devashishta, there are, when we read these, there are so many systems of, dimensions of classifying that it's kind of becomes difficult to track them. Is that something that, knowledge that we amass as we go along?
It becomes difficult to what?
To track the different classifications.
You mean these states, these avasthas?
Right now these avasthas, but in various parts we come across different such classifications.
Yeah, but you see here he is bringing these up here. He has brought out a number of views on life throughout, as we see. But now he has turned these so-called philosophies towards practice. And so he's saying if we actually attempt to engage ourselves in some kind of life or vital change, what is it that we will focus our life towards as towards a goal? Then we are presented with these three major fields. These are the kshetras, you may say, that need to be known and that need to be we need to be effective upon through knowledge. So what kshetra will we choose? This is the question over here. And the reason that he divides it into three is that there is in our embodied consciousness or state a certain sort of, you know, division between the, a discontinuity between these three. That's the reason why he brings it up, because as he's saying, no one of them are exclusive. So if they were exclusive, then it would have been relatively easy for us to make a choice and say that, okay, this is what we choose, or the other is what we choose, and proceed along that line. The whole race of humanity would then be divided into three kinds, and we possibly would have had three kinds of evolution. But also it is true that we are not integrated. We do have these three different kinds of orientations of life itself. And so these orientations of life are based on certain universal truths. And that's what he's bringing out. He's showing that they exist, and we can actually take an orientation towards one or the other. But because they are not integral, in some sense, the whole race does not embrace it, because there is an interdependence between them and a certain evolutionary push, movement, towards the effectuation of this interdependence.
So, as an individual, it seems that it would not be possible to choose a particular orientation and stick with it. Rather, you are always presented with the attractions of the other orientations too.
Yes, yes. Now, people do choose one and stick with it, and that's why he points to two or three different options there of those who actually move towards one or the other, even though it is not complete. And he says that any view of our being which neglects, unduly belittles, or intolerantly condemns them, in other words, the natural impulse, the sort of life, the cosmic terrestrial life, is therefore by that very fact, whatever its other truth or merit or utility, or whatever its suitability to individuals of a certain temperament or in a certain stage of spiritual evolution, unfit to be the general and complete rule of human living. So this clause over there, suitability to individuals of a certain temperament or in a certain stage of spiritual evolution, sort of covers for this kind of an adhikar in certain people that drives them towards one or the other of these other avasthas. So that can exist. But he's saying that that cannot become general in the mass. And even in those in whom it exists as a predominant predisposition, they usually can achieve those particular goals through a denial of the cosmic terrestrial. This is one of the things you see about the Indian yogic tradition. It's very interesting because you see the yogic tradition was created in such a way over the centuries. I mean, there might have been a time when it was very integrated with life. But then what happened is that it was given a certain independent place. And this is a social manifestation of what one might call these avasthas. Because the absolute and the seeking of the absolute has to be given a certain degree of absolute freedom. And that absolute freedom was given in society through the existence of the sannyasi tradition. The sannyasi was not bound by society in any way. But there was a certain interdependence in that society maintained the sannyasi as its own potential towards freedom. And the sannyasi maintained himself through his interaction with society on the level of material existence or survival. But because of that freedom given to the potential for the supracosmic, that there was a certain kind of entry into the field of life of spiritual motives, spiritual aspirations, and a spiritualization or a certain orientation towards spirituality of Indian life. So we had many kinds of cultural manifestations of the spiritual, but these were all sort of, as he says, halfway houses, ways in which we found a window to the beyond, to either the supra-terrestrial or the supra-cosmic. But ultimately, there was a certain domain which was totally outside of this that was to be affirmed as the true world of spirit. Now, this kind of condition, however, led to a situation where over time we lost our hold on material existence. A certain kind of negation, pessimism came in. But why then should we have a full-blooded life on earth? So it was easy in a sense for us to become subject nation. Mm-hmm. Now, what has happened as a result is that the whole system, the social system, which was hinging around the, you know, invisible centrality of the sannyasi, you may say, has sort of changed its significances. Its meanings have changed completely. So that to the large number of people on in the social plane in India today, it is more a kind of sort of a global sort of enjoyment of, you know, sort of a modern life, which figures as the goal. And along with it comes a certain notion of the ethical value of work, so to say, which is a kind of, you know, sort of a slant that in one way denies freedom to the domain of the spirit, so that the sannyasi loses significance and value. Sannyasi is seen just as a beggar who couldn't do otherwise than, you know, beg because he doesn't want to work. See, the ethical sort of imperative is not applying on him because he has chosen against it in denial of the sort of, you know, imperative to produce. So that kind of change, in some senses, upset the entire balance. But what it has done is it has given a certain kind of value to the social existence of material life, which had become sort of, you know, emaciated at a certain point.
But what would be the way to reconcile the two? Because I mean, given that somebody is predominantly living in his lower nature and his or her lower nature and wants to progress, then it seems that to some degree cutting off can be helped many times, right?
Yes. No, so basically what has happened is that it's what he's calling over here the intelligence of nature. Nature takes good care that the race shall not neglect these aims, etc. So basically what this means is that the social form has changed and therefore the significances have changed. But that does not mean that the search, aspiration or seeking should disappear. That now the need is really to attain to a full sort of, you know, valuation of the spiritual life within the material, that we have to give a spiritual orientation to our life, material life itself. The Jagrat has to become the basis, not of a denial of earth and kind of a sort of escape into supra-terrestrial realms or a complete escape into the supra-cosmic, but has to become like a sort of a base where the interdependence of these avastas is realized, with the consequent transformation of our social existence.
So how is this, how is it that one can, that we can as a society guard against going in the opposite, to the opposite end?
You mean the supracosmic end?
No, I mean when you have
Extreme materialism.
yes, exactly. Yeah, that's what
You
extreme
mean the
materialism.
extreme materialism end?
Yes, that's what I meant, Devashish.
There is no way of guarding against it because you see that in a sense is where we are going right now. I mean, the majority of the people of this country are going in that direction. But you see what Sri Aurobindo is saying in this paragraph, and he will bring it up in the next paragraph, is that this cannot be the stopping point because the other aspirations are also present in us. So it can only be a temporary sort of a way station. This predominance of the material life. Also, you realize that he begins the whole life divine with what he calls the human aspiration, where what he is saying is that these major universal aspirations for truth, light, immortality, etc., are sort of truths because they endure the cycles of our changes. I mean, in spite of the fact that we go through different kinds of movements in the race, pushing us towards one or other of these avasthas, these aspirations come back. They have come back again and again, and sooner or later we find that we have to obey their call. So you could say this is, to put it like that, is a kind of fatalism, because we are kind of saying that, you know, we are in this material age today, but inevitably we'll swing around to a spiritual age. I'm not claiming that in that sense, there is a certain degree of that feeling in saying that there is an inevitability in the fact that we will at some point affirm these other avasthas because they also live inside us. But at the same time, there are other more sort of pressing mechanisms. For example, a tradition which has lived for so many hundreds or thousands of years can go under the surface but cannot die out. And so there have to be people who will generate it in their own lives. The very fact that here we are studying this text means that that aspiration has some hold on us. We may be a few people, but the fact is that you know, the affirmation of these aspirations is the only way in which social transformation can come about as it goes forth into the world.
Debashishta, I just want to go back to the text of the Mandukya Upanishad, and there's this thing that the Jagrat and the Swapna state, it says it has 7 limbs and 19 doors. So I was wondering if this is the correct forum, if you can just mention what these are.
I think those are technical details that are better taken outside of this. I think, you know, it gets too technical,
Sure,
you know, to
no
look at
problem.
those distinctions, etc.
Yes, let's move on then. We can read the next paragraph maybe. Sita, you want to read?
Also, she has implemented in us a sense that there is something in our composition which goes beyond this first terrestrial nature of humanity. For this reason, the race cannot accept or follow for a very long time any
I cannot hear you. Can you speak a little louder, Sitaram?
Sure. How is now? For this reason, the race cannot accept or follow for a very long time any view of being which ignores this higher and subtler sense and labors to confine us entirely to a purely terrestrial way of living. The intuition of a beyond, the idea and feeling of a soul and spirit in us, which is other than mind, life and body, or is greater, not limited by their formula, returns upon us and ends by resuming possession. The ordinary man satisfies this sense easily enough by devoting it to his exceptional moments, or the latter part of his life when age shall have blunted the gist of his earthly nature, or by recognizing it as something behind or above his normal action to which he can move, which he can more or less perfectly direct his natural being. The exceptional man turns to the superterrestrial as the one aim and law of living, and diminishes or mortifies as much as possible his earthly parts in the hope of developing his celestial nature. There have been epochs in which the superterrestrial view has gained a very powerful hold, and there has been a vacillation between an imperfect human living which cannot take its large natural expansion and a sick ascetic longing for the celestial life, which also does not acquire in more than a few its best pure and happy moment. This is a sign of the creation of some false war in the being by the setting up of a standard or a device that ignores the law of evolutionary capacity, or an overstress that misses the reconciling equation which must exist somewhere in a divine dispensation of our nature.
So you see here he is making that point that none of these can actually remain forever or for a very long time. The stopping point of exclusive human focus in life, that there is a certain kind of, you know, particularly in terms of the material life, that there is, as he said, something in us which is independent from matter, and it begins feeling that it is imprisoned, and that there is a certain natural domain to it which is outside of this material world, that there is a certain kind of supraterrestrial home, abode of this part of our being, the consciousness part. Now, that may not sort of immediately assert itself as a certain kind of an independent principle. It may work under the surface, as for example in our present time, in our contemporary age, we find that the sort of theoretical paradigm under which, or regime under which we live, is one of materialism. But at the same time, at the popular level, there is growing more and more a certain kind of a new age orientation, an orientation towards various kinds of, you may say, technologies of consciousness. Now, these consciousness sort of paradigms or technologies, however, are still operating under the regime of materialism and its own goal goals, aims, sort of organization. And therefore, you may say that they are becoming very easily co-opted. They are becoming the subjective side of an objective living. In no deep sense transformative of its structure. However, it may be that this is a beginning, and in a certain way it is an opening to the recognition of the fact that our focus on the material life is no longer exclusive, that its exclusive nature is reducing its power. And it may just be a question of time before voices arise, and that is the important thing, that such voices must arise, that give a more radical dimension to the subjective life and the subjective goals or orientations of consciousness. And so we find that there is a certain kind of a swing that takes place. But if the move towards the subjective life becomes exclusive in its own way, if the extraterrestrial or supracosmic, and in this case he's talking more about the extraterrestrial, if the extraterrestrial becomes predominant, then there it's like a seesaw. There is a movement towards the denial of the material. This to some extent, you know, happened during the 60s and 70s in the West, in America and Europe, with the hippie movement, where the whole idea was, you know, we are leaving, you don't need us. You see, so it's this wooden ships on the water, you know, we're kind of leaving. The philosophy of exile. The inner life as the sort of, you know, proper domain, but a domain which becomes exclusive and exiles itself from the material world. Now, that kind of a movement ultimately is doomed to failure, which is what happened. It leaves its seeds in the material, but nevertheless it gets wiped out, it gets extincted, because either it ends up by drying up the founts of natural creativity and social manifestation, or it ends up denying the, you know, or both actually, I mean, sort of moving into such subtleties that it basically vaporizes itself from the earth. So that's what he's talking about over there, that there have been civilizations and times when this kind of a focus on the subjective side, the extraterrestrial type, supraterrestrial sort of side, has been predominant. The exceptional man turns to the supraterrestrial as the one aim and law of living and diminishes or mortifies as much as possible his earthly parts in the hope of developing his celestial nature. There have been epochs in which the supraterrestrial view has gained a very powerful hold, and there has been a vacillation between an imperfect human living which cannot take its large natural expansion and a sick ascetic longing for the celestial life, which also does not acquire in more than a few its best, pure and happy movement. So here you have these two poles, because you've sort of put all the focus of concentration on the supraterrestrial, the earthly life has lost its sanction, its foundation, as it were, its source of you know, I mean, acceptance. And therefore, it becomes this kind of a sort of imperfect human living, which cannot take its large natural expression. It's constantly maimed by certain sanctions and certain repressions, social repressions. Or on the other hand, there is a kind of a wholehearted turning, but that becomes a sick ascetic longing for the celestial life. It's sick because, in a sense, again, it's exclusive and it is denying the life of the social manifestation of Jagrat. So that is why he's saying that this is a sign of the creation of some false war in the being by the setting up of a standard or a device that ignores the law of evolutionary capacity. or an overstress that misses the reconciling equation, which must exist somewhere in a divine dispensation of our nature. He's saying it's evidently a proof, you know, that there is a certain kind of problem here.
Devashishta by any chance?
Devashishta?
Hello? Oh.
Okay. Hello, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I'm still here.
Okay.
So, Devashishta, just as it is nature's habit to bring people down or to ground them to the material world, is the ethical world also very close to the material world? And it's actually a device of nature to bring people close and to impose social rules on them or duties.
What? Where were you quoting from?
Oh, no, I was just asking. I wasn't quoting.
Repeat your question again.
No, because I have seen in a lot of Indian texts, or especially the later texts, not the core texts of Vedas or Upanishads or Gita, it has a lot of social sayings, especially leading on to altruism. So is that a way of society to safeguard that people don't vanish into sannyas?
Yes, both of them. I mean, you have also a very strong ethical sort of dimension. And the ethical dimension is basically concerned, as you pointed out earlier, with our other life, you know, with what happens. I mean, what is the point? And there are two justifications for ethics. One is that we have to live together. Human beings find themselves crammed in a single room, you know, I mean, to put it bluntly, because the earth, however large we may conceive of it, is ultimately, you know, too tight a room for our huge egos. So we have to live together without stamping each other out. So we need some rules. That becomes one of the grounds for ethics. The other one becomes that, you know, there is another life, a life outside of this world, a life beyond death, or a life even within the world which, you know, has a certain kind of a development, you know, which is invisible, an invisible development of some kind. And ethics answers to that. So in both cases, there is a certain ethical dimension that comes up. Now, in the Indian case, we find that the ethical dimension answers to both these things. One is to maintaining the social impulse as a kind of a moving together, samsara, that is, a being together and a moving together as the human race, as a form of the keeping together of the world in loka sangraha. Mm-hmm. So that is one dimension, and the other dimension is that there is a ethical sort of orientation towards the inner life, you know, the denial of the flesh to some extent, or at least the overcoming of the impulses of the material desire. So that becomes the ground of ethics. But as Sri Aurobindo points out, an overly ethical sort of formulation already implies that the aspiration of the race has shifted from its natural ground in the spiritual. It has already moved towards, I mean, you need to, I mean, this is the differentiation between into orthodoxy and heterodoxy. We need an orthodoxy when we find that the natural and unspoken ground of our existence has been defied and defiled, you may say, is no longer pure. And therefore, we have to make choices, and the attractive choice is often that which is against that which would keep us in our source. So then we start developing orthodoxies, and ethics is basically one aspect of an orthodoxy.
And what is heterodoxy?
Heterodoxy would be a creative and conscious choice which defies all the rules but creates its own rules as it goes along. Does not bind itself to any orthodox structure.
I guess in the 60s, especially in America, that in America and Europe, that was the movement against orthodoxy and reaching out to some sort of heterodoxy.
Yes, you may say so. Yes.
I think in America, though, that was the secular movement. Also, I think it's possible for heterodoxies to exist within orthodoxies. And, you know, I'm thinking also, you know, sort of orthodoxies inside heterodoxies, because although American society, you know, is largely secular in character, I mean, we found over the past 2 years how much orthodoxy has been sort of moving things. And also, you know, even sort of, and there's also an economic structure that's sort of, you know, orthodox, but within it, there's sort of this technological sort of heterodoxy that happens in innovation, and where it leads, you know, sometimes it may exceed the reach of the orthodoxy, but, you know, generally that's the struggle, and generally, you know, technology or heterodoxy generally becomes again enclosed within an orthodoxy. So I think they're interrelated.
Yes, no doubt they are. Actually, you may say that the orthodoxy and heterodoxy can both be both sort of religious or secular. You could have secular orthodoxies and secular heterodoxies. And that's, I guess, what you were pointing out. Right. And that heterodoxies may exist within orthodoxies. But then that depends really on how radical they are. So, but they are interdependent. It's true that they both spring from the ground of doxa, which are the sort of questioned assumptions that we start with, and they also can integrate back into doxa, or reintegrate into doxa to some extent at certain stages. So, it's a kind of a dialectical field.
And I think also these four modes of knowledge, I mean, they're also a dialectic somewhat set up in between it. I mean, as you mentioned, with the passing of time, it might favor one sort of one extreme or another. But there's also sort of a dialectic in, as we talked about a few weeks ago, within every sort of extreme part of it, there's sort of, every one of them also represents sort of, you know, I think maybe within a dialectic itself, something of the integral purview.
Yes, no doubt, yes. Yes, and that is the aim or goal, as he's going to bring it out, which is that, you know, there is a sort of interdependence of these three types of theories of existence and their kind of life orientations. There is an amalgam, as he's pointing out somewhere in reality, but he's pointing to an integrality later where each one of these orientations can actually include the others. Mm. And, you know, sort of see a route which, you know, affirms their interdependence. While still maintaining the dialectic. Mm. I think that maintenance of the dialectic while affirming the integrality is one of the contributions of Sri Aurobindo, in that he does not sort of flatten any one of these states that he sets up, or he kind of, you know, puts forward as being interrelated. but shows their coexistence with and their integrality with other sort of dialectic states while maintaining their independence.
And I think this is what we're also speaking of as far as these sort of integral theories that are sort of the current sort of vogue in some stations. That, you know, that's one of the beautiful things where Aurobindo is presenting here, is sort of this coexistence without sort of reifying it into any sort of structure that can be easily sort of deconstructed.
Yes, yes, exactly.
Actually, in thinking about it, I mean, he manages almost to perform a deconstruction on his own text to bring out the really sort of, you know, illumination within it.
Yes, it's true. It's true. He does. I mean, and the sweep of each of these as he kind of opens them up and lays them out, and then sort of, you know, sort of cuts the ground under each of them, as it were. And then, you know, shows their interdependence more and more clearly, you know, I mean, as a sort of inextricable, you know, sort of combination.
So we can, in the name of tolerance or some other ethical considerations, you can kind of accept that everything has to coexist. But how does it become more intrinsic to the nature than just tolerance of other viewpoints?
See, tolerance would again put us into the domain of ethics and orthodoxies. If we have to tolerate other viewpoints, that means that we have to affirm that a certain viewpoint to a certain number of people is the right one. And that is a natural process. It happens in that way. You know, I mean, there is no getting away from it. But at the same time, there must arise these cultures of deconstruction. So exactly what Sri Aurobindo is doing, have to arise and enter into the social arena. There have to be people who can actually voice this, and languages and vocabularies that are developed so as to be able to effectively carry across this kind of either an integral or a certain kind of a, you know, an integral viewpoint that actually does not exist in contradistinction to any one of these. So, you know, true heterodoxy, in fact, a radical heterodoxy is where each one of the doxas or orthodoxies is illuminated through both its deconstruction as well as its reconstitution in a larger light, mm-hmm. in a more interdependent light, so that it is shown for what it is, and it is shown as a direction of growth, but at the same time it is shown as not something which can exist just by tolerating others, mm-hmm. but by recognizing their necessary coexistence.
Yeah, I guess, and that takes us back to the original quote that the knowledge that unites is the true knowledge.
Yes, exactly. For example, I mean, to take again another very, very common type of dialectic within Indian sort of schools of mystic traditions, you have Shaivite and Vaishnav traditions. And Sri Aurobindo has pointed out that, you know, their wars ultimately kind of boil down to very basic kind of a differentiation of aim or aspiration. And again, that relates to Swadharma to some extent. And that is, are we to be liberated? What is the greatest good? Or what is the greatest, you know, sort of goal of human existence. And to the Shaivites, it is liberation. But to the Vaishnavites, it is servitude to the Ishvara, servitude to God. Now, these two as two contending goals of life, again, have to be seen in the same light, that each one of them is absolutely necessary. And at the same time, neither of them is sufficient. And that they are interdependent. And that there is a reality beyond them which illumines them. And at the same time, each one of them can be made a way to enter into that integral framework. By, and then it becomes not a question of tolerance, but a question of the recognition of the necessity of the other. Mm-hmm. While at the same time, an affirmation of the need to accept for oneself under the regime of mind a single direction or orientation.
Shall we read the next paragraph?
Yes, let's move on.
Swami, you want to read?
Sure. But finally, there must open in us, as our mental life deepens and subtler knowledge develops, the perception that the terrestrial and the supraterrestrial are not the only terms of being. There is something which is supracosmic and the highest remote origin of our existence. This perception is easily associated by spiritual enthusiasm, by the height and ardor of the soul's aspiration, by the philosophic aloofness or the strict logical intolerance of our intellect, by the eagerness of our will, or by a sick disgust in our vital being, discouraged by the difficulties or disappointed by the results of life. By any or all of these motive forces, with a sense of the entire vanity and unreality of all else than this remote supreme, the vanity of human life, the unreality of cosmic existence, the bitter ugliness and cruelty of earth, the insufficiency of heaven, the aimlessness of the repetition of births in the body. Here again, the ordinary man cannot really live with these ideas. They can only give at most a grayness and restless dissatisfaction to the life in which he must still continue. But the exceptional man abandons all to follow the truth he has seen, and for him, they can be the needed food of his spiritual impulse or a stimulus to the one achievement that is now for him the one thing that matters. Periods and countries there have been in which this view of being has become very powerful. A considerable part of the race has swerved aside to the life of the ascetic, not always with a real call to it. The rest adhered to the normal life but with an underlying belief in its unreality, a belief which can bring about by too much reiteration and insistence an unnerving of the life impulse and an increasing littleness of its motives, or even by a subtle reaction, an absorption in an ordinary narrow living through a missing of our natural response to the divine being's larger joy in cosmic existence, and a failure of the great progressive human idealism by which we are spurred to a collective self-development and a noble embrace of the battle and the labor. Here again, there is a sign of some insufficiency in the statement of the supracosmic reality. Perhaps an overstatement or a mistaken opposition, a missing of the divine equation, of the total sense of creation and the entire will of the Creator.
actually placing this supracosmic aspiration at a point where our mental life deepens and subtler knowledge develops. So it's, as it were, its necessity and even our intuition of it grows only to the degree that we embrace the other two worlds, to the degree that both our inner and psychological life becomes more rich and our outer existence develops a certain kind of, you know, fullness. Because with these, then there comes a certain sense of either a beyond to both of them or a certain kind of sense of insufficiency or unfulfillment, as he's saying, in both cases. So then also there is a perception of the universal laws which actually pertain to both these domains. Then in some sense, the inner world, the world of Swapna, may be more subtle than the world of Jagrat, but it is nevertheless a world, which means it is a system of forces. It is an entrapment. It is itself a structure in which we can be, you know, sort of defined, self-defined in a limited way. And something in us knows that we exceed these or cannot be entrapped by these formulations or within these formulations. And so he points out to the various ways in which this particular intuition may arise. There is a spiritual enthusiasm or the height and ardor of the soul's aspiration, the philosophic aloofness or the strict logical intolerance of our intellect. So all these would become various kinds of extremist sort of otherworldly movements that ultimately are pointing to a station beyond even the subjective existence, to an absolute. In other words, which has come to the understanding that the subjective life is also a conditioned domain. It is not absolute. It is another kind of relative world. And there is a kind of a radical infinite existence, a plenitude, which has to have its own hermetic domain. In other words, shut from the expressive domains of whether the subjective life or the objective life. Something so complete and infinite that its infinity cannot be violated. You know, no stain can stain it, no wound can wound it, no cut can dismember it. So it remains whole in spite of whatever we may do to it. This kind of an absolute becomes the seeking. But somehow it is also sort of seen or experienced not as an integral absolute, as an absolute which, if it is indivisible, is also present within Swapna and Jagrat, but absent in these worlds, only attainable through the experience of absence, through neti, through the affirmation of the negation. So that becomes, in a sense, and then that is also related to a perception of the essential unpleasantness, insufficiency, or even repulsive nature of all manifest things. And as he says over there, the vanity of human life, the unreality of cosmic existence, the bitter ugliness and cruelty of earth, the insufficiency of heaven, the aimlessness of the repetition of births in the body. And in this kind of extreme seeking for that which is beyond, which cannot be named, which refuses to be named, that gives the stress to the aspiration of the Buddha. Also to Jainism, for example, because you know they don't talk about the negation of things in a nirvana, but they talk of kevala. In other words, the alone, the absolute, the root which excludes all others. Not the inclusive root, but the exclusive root. So we have this kind of a kind of a pole star that pulls us out of our bondage, one may say, to any manifest world, whether of the outer or the inner realms. In the case of Buddhism, there is even the notion that the inner life hankers after the outer life. See that? In a sense, after one dies, not only does one traverse worlds of hell, but one traverses them with material desires. And that makes it even more painful. Because in a sense, one's desires have not disappeared, and yet their sense of fulfillment is even more pathetic, since they cannot get that material sense, that concreteness in their fulfillment. So the basic law of desire keeps us entrapped in both these worlds. These are both conditionings. And hence there must exist a realm which is exclusive of these structural norms or bindings. And that would become this ultimate root. So that is the kind of supracosmic goal. And as he says that there have been periods and countries, and he is thinking of India, and he is thinking of certain other sort of times and domains in Asia, in which there is this kind of underlying belief in the unreality of the normal life, a belief which can bring about by too much reiteration and insistence, an unnerving of the life impulse and an increasing littleness of its motive. So it discards the material realm to a kind of a, you know, a sort of a petty domain, a domain which is unworthy, and leaves it to a certain kind of unworthiness of goals. Or even by a subtle reaction, an absorption in an ordinary narrow living through a missing of our natural response to the divine being's larger joy in cosmic existence, and a failure of the great progressive human idealism, which we are spurred to a collective self-development, noble embrace of the battle and the labor. So that becomes the diminution of life that takes place. It is relegated to a domain of apathy and of pettiness, and of the rampant affirmation of the life of desires. Now this, in a sense, you may say, is the cycle through which civilizations like India are still passing through, because it's in reaction to that we are where we are today. The materialism of India today is a kind of a reaction, because when a certain idealism is withdrawn from life, when it returns from another kind of culture, as a certain kind of a, you know, as a self-interest and an interest in material possession and desire, then that becomes the goal that replaces the littleness that had been given or bestowed to the meaning of life. And the earlier, as a reaction to the earlier otherworldly stress, and that particular stress becomes a sort of an erasure, something which is denied in the sort of progressive new kind of idealism that affirms a certain life of the ego and the desire in the material world. But as he says over here, that there is a disbalance here. Here again, there is a sign of some insufficiency in the statement of the supracosmic reality, perhaps an overstatement or a mistaken opposition, a missing of the divine equation, of the total sense of creation and the entire will of the Creator.
Shall we read the next?
Yes, we can do that.
Meera, you want to read?
Yeah, I'll read it.
Meera.
That equation can only be found if we recognize the purport of our whole complex human nature in its right place in the cosmic moment. What is needed is to give its full legitimate value to each part of our composite being and many-sided aspiration, and find out the key of their unity as well as their difference. The finding must be by a synthesis or an integration, and since development is clearly the law of the human soul, it is most likely to be discovered by an evolutionary synthesis. A synthesis of this kind was attempted in the ancient Indian culture. It accepted four legitimate motives of human living: man's vital interest and needs, his desires, his ethical and religious aspiration, his ultimate spiritual aim and destiny. In other words, the claims of his vital, physical and emotional being, the claims of his ethical and religious being, governed by a knowledge of the law of God and nature and man, and the claims of his spiritual longing for the beyond, for which he seeks satisfaction by an ultimate release from an ignorant, mundane existence. It provided for a period of education and preparation based on this idea of life, a period of normal living to satisfy human desires and interest under the moderating rule of the ethical and religious part in us, a period of withdrawal and spiritual preparation, and a last period of renunciation of life and release into the spirit. Evidently, if applied as a universal rule, this prescribed norm, this delineation of the curve of our journey, would miss the fact that it is impossible for all to trace out the whole circle of development in a single short lifetime, but it was modified by the theory of a complete evolution pursued through a long succession of rebirths before one could be fit for a spiritual liberation. This synthesis, with its spiritual insight, largeness of view, symmetry, completeness, did much to raise the tone of human life, but eventually it collapsed. Its place was occupied by an exaggeration of the impulse of renunciation, which destroyed the symmetry of the system and cut it into two moments of life in opposition to each other. The normal life of interest and desires with an ethical and religious coloring, and the abnormal or supernormal inner life founded on renunciation. The old synthesis, in fact, contained in itself the seed of this exaggeration and could not but lapse into it. For if we regard the escape from life as our desirable end, if we omit to hold up any high offer of life fulfillment, if life has not a divine significance in it, the impatience of the human intellect and will must end by driving at a shortcut and getting rid as much as possible of any more tedious and dilatory processes. If it cannot do that, or if it is incapable of following the shortcut, it is left with the ego and its satisfactions, but with nothing greater to be achieved here. Life is split into the spiritual and the mundane, and there can only be an abrupt transition, not a harmony or reconciliation of these parts of our nature.
So in this very powerful paragraph, Sri Aurobindo is introducing and critiquing the Indian social system, as it were, that is actually based or derived out of the Upanishads of the four Chaturpurushartha, as they are called, the four aims of life and the Chaturashrama, that is the four stations of life, that is in terms of the kinds of sort of life fulfillments that one goes through. And he prefaces that by talking about the fact that once we recognize that each of these views of existence as life orientations is incomplete in itself, that we need to actually give or affirm both the power of some commonality or unity between these, the root of that which unites, and at the same time between the distinctiveness, the independence, the difference between these, that we have to affirm both of these at the same time. And we have to look for something, a solution, which actually can maintain these two simultaneously. Can there be something which unites and yet divides? Something which gives reality to each of these and yet holds them together as a principle that pervades them, that is intrinsic to each of them. And so he is looking for something that is either a synthesis or an integration. Can we formulate such a synthesis or an integration? And so he is looking for a principle that will be the basis of that. And as he says, that can, because that is related to the law of the human soul, the developmental law, one may say, so we have to look at the notion of an evolutionary synthesis. That is how he arrives at a certain kind of principle where we can seek for a key. And then he looks at a model, and that model is what has been developed in ancient India. And this model he points to is, as he says in the beginning, something which divided the human world of interests or motives into four. And this is as he describes them, man's vital interests and needs, artha, his desires, kama, his ethical and religious aspiration, dharma, and his ultimate spiritual aim and destiny, moksha. So these become the four goals of human life, you know, the purusharthas as they are called. Each of them is important. As he says over there, we are a composite being and we have many-sided aspirations. So these are the various aspirations which we have. Now, to give each its due, as it were, becomes the aim over here. So this is one way of looking at it. You present these and then you kind of, he sort of reduces them to three from four, which is very, you know, much in keeping with the three views that he has introduced. And they are the claims of his vital, physical and emotional being, which relate to the world of Jagrat. By a knowledge of the law of God and nature in man, that is the world of, you know, partly of the external world of social conduct, but partly also of the internal world of religious experience, of devotion, of the world of the gods, the devas and the asuras, that entire domain inside us. And then you have the third, which is the claims of a spiritual longing for the beyond, for which he seeks satisfaction by an ultimate release from an ignorant, mundane existence. So that becomes the supra-cosmic, you know, root, one may say. So therefore, in society, it introduces certain legitimate set of stations, you know, temporal structures, one may say. And these temporal structures are a period of education and preparation, that is brahmacharya, period of normal living to satisfy human desires and interests, grihasthya, under the moderating rule of the ethical and religious part in us, a period of withdrawal and spiritual preparation, that is vanaprastha, and a last period of renunciation of life and release into the spirit, which is sannyas. The earlier, one may say, pre-Shankara notion of sannyas. Evidently, if applied as a universal rule, this prescribed norm, this delineation of the curve of our journey would miss the fact that it is impossible for all to trace out the whole circle of development in a single short lifetime. See, and this is one of those great ironies of human existence, which is that the human body runs its wick out pretty quickly, but the human vital with its desires and the human mind with its cosmic range of knowledge very hugely outlasts the body. So how can we map this kind of grand scheme of the different parts of the being and our different aspirations to this very limited physical life? Again, we come back to the insufficiency, but our dependence upon material existence to achieve anything in this life, in this embodied life. So here we find that, you know, the law of rebirth comes in as the solution, but it was modified by the theory of a complete evolution pursued through a long succession of rebirths before one could be fit for a spiritual liberation. So there would be an eventual satisfaction of the spiritual impulse, but that would come after a series of rebirths in which, through the operation of the law of karma, these other aspirations were gradually quelled and we were left with the purity of the spiritual impulse in us. So this, he says, is a certain synthesis. It had a spiritual insight, a largeness of view, symmetry and completion, and it did much to raise the tone of human life. But eventually it collapsed. And he points to why it collapsed. It collapsed because even though it recognizes the reality of all these various, you know, domains of existence, as well as these, you know, psychological links which we have with these domains of existence as legitimate aspirations, yet it prioritizes the supra-cosmic. it actually makes the supracosmic the only real and legitimate goal in all this. The others are sort of, you know, because we are helpless and because we are conditioned, we have to allow them to exist. There is no philosophical meaning given to the sort of integrality of this system. Why should we, you know, ultimately give our adherence to the other three if moksha is the ultimate goal of our existence? So that's why he says that it is in a sense inevitable that this kind of a system is going to ultimately break up into two primary opposed modes, one which affirms the material life and the other which affirms the spiritual life. The old synthesis, in fact, contained in itself the seed of this exaggeration and could not but lapse into it. For if we regard the escape from life as our desirable end, if we omit to hold up any high offer of life fulfillment, if life has not a divine significance in it, the impatience of the human intellect and will must end by driving at a shortcut and getting rid as much as possible of any more tedious and dilatory processes. It cannot do that, or if it is incapable of following the shortcut, it is left with the ego and its satisfactions, but with nothing greater to be achieved here. So this becomes basically the two ends between which existence will swing. Life is split into the spiritual and the mundane, and there can be only an abrupt transition, not a harmony or reconciliation of these parts of our nature. So in a sense, as Rich was saying, he presents this solution from the past, but then cuts at its roots, deconstructs it, points to its inevitable failure, as it were, at the same time as he points to some kind of truth and insight, spiritual insight, working in it.
I have a question. So when this system was in place, let us say a couple of hundreds of years or thousands of years ago, if this system was working and in place, why didn't we see the much more utopian society, and why did the degeneration happen?
Repeat again, why didn't we see what kind of society?
I mean, much more utopian type of society. We should have seen that type of society, and it should not have degraded or degenerated to the present situation, right?
No, but this is exactly what he's saying. He's saying that the problem is that utopian society, we have seen glorious periods of Indian civilization in which this particular spiritual impulse has made its appearance in life. But somehow it has not come with the goal of transforming life. It has, all these philosophies and these social systems have assumed that life is going to be ultimately the domain of avidya, that we can catch glimpses. World is a kind of a window into the spiritual world. But spiritual life or spiritual world has to be distinct, kept distinct from the domain of life. So what he's saying is that we have had periods when there has been a much greater sort of, you know, a more positive, you know, manifestation of this system. But the intellect, as he points out here, in a way, we are mind creatures. And particularly the more we get into a rationalistic age, we enter into the curve of reason, as he has called it elsewhere, that we find that, in a sense, we cannot, cannot but use the intellect to arrive at why, the question why. Why should we affirm all these complexities when the real goal of life is to go beyond? See, so there is a natural, inevitable degradation in the system itself. That is what he's pointing out. So long as the system is maintained by a certain kind of idealism, this is okay. But as soon as this system starts meeting other kinds of systems, and this is the whole idea of culture contact, to some extent, culture contact helps in the breaking down of all structures. Because you see other civilizations that have other kinds of intentions with life. And then you start asking the question, why should we do the things that we do? And so then the whole notion comes that either we should pursue from the beyond, or we should freely enjoy our mundane lives. And that brings about the division. It's inevitable, because we don't find any spiritual root in life as a certain kind of a transformable sort of field. I think we should come to an end now, because I will have to leave. So maybe if we can read one more, just read, and then end today. Okay.
Shyam, you want to read?
Yeah. Ask anybody else.
A spiritual evolution, an unfolding here of the being within from birth to birth, of which man becomes the central instrument and human life at its highest, offers the critical turning point, is the link needed for the reconciliation of life and spirit. For it allows us to take into account the total nature of man and to recognize the legitimate place of his triple attraction to earth, to heaven, and to the supreme reality. But a complete solution of its oppositions can be arrived at only on this basis, that the lower consciousness of mind, life, and body cannot arrive at its full meaning until it is taken up, restated, transformed by the light and power and joy of the higher spiritual consciousness. While the higher too does not stand in its full right relation to the lower by mere rejection, but by this assumption and domination, this takes up of its unfulfilled values, this restatement of transformation. A spiritualizing and supramentalizing of the mental, vital, and physical nature. The terrestrial ideal, which has been so powerful in the modern mind, restored man and his life on earth and the collective hope of the race to a prominent position, and created an insistent demand for a solution. This is the good it has accomplished. But by overdoing and exclusiveness, it unduly limited man's scope. It ignored that which is the highest and in the end the largest thing in him. And by this limitation, it missed the full pursuit of its own object. If mind were the highest thing in man and nature, then indeed this frustration might not result. Still, the limitation of scope would be there, a narrow possibility, a circumscribed prospect. But if mind is only a partial unfolding of consciousness, and there are powers beyond of which nature in our race is capable, then not only does our hope upon earth, let alone what is beyond it, depend upon their development, but this becomes the one proper road of our evolution.
So I think we'll end here because I have to leave now. We'll take it up again next time.
Yeah, sure. Let's end with a small meditation.